Sphere by Michael Crichton. Copyright 1987 by Michael Crichton. Narrated by Bob Askey. For Lynn Nesbitt. When a scientist views things, he's not considering the incredible at all. Louis I. Kahn. You can't fool nature. Richard Feynman. During the preparation of this manuscript, I received help and encouragement from Caroline Conley, Kurt Villidson, Lisa Plonsker, Valerie Pine, Anne Marie Martin, John Dubert, Lynn Nesbitt, and Bob Gottlieb. I am grateful to them all. The Surface. West of Tonga. For a long time, the horizon had been a monotonous flat blue line separating the Pacific Ocean from the sky. The Navy helicopter raced forward, flying low, near the waves. Despite the noise and the thumping vibration of the blades, Norman Johnson fell asleep. He was tired. He had been traveling on various military aircraft for more than 14 hours. It was not the kind of thing a 53-year-old professor of psychology was used to. He had no idea how long he slept. When he awoke, he saw that the horizon was still flat. There were white semicircles of coral atolls ahead. He said over the intercom, "What's this?"
"Islands of Ninihina and Tafahi," the pilot said. "Technically part of Tonga, but they're uninhabited. Good sleep?" "Not bad."
Norman looked at the islands as they flashed by, a curve of white sand, a few palm trees, then gone. The flat ocean again.
"Where'd they bring you in from?"
the pilot asked. "San Diego," Norman said. "I left yesterday."
"So you came Honolulu, Guam, Pongo, here?"
"That's right."
"Long trip,"
the pilot said.
"What kind of work you do, sir?"
"I'm a psychologist," Norman said.
"A shrink, huh?"
the pilot grinned.
"Why not? They've called in just about everything else."
"How do you mean?"
"We've been ferrying people out of Guam for the last 2 days. Physicists, biologists, mathematicians, you name it. Everybody being flown to the middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean."
"What's going on?" Norman said. The pilot glanced at him, eyes unreadable behind dark aviator sunglasses.
"They're not telling us anything, sir. What about you? What'd they tell you?"
"They told me," Norman said, "that there was an airplane crash."
"Uh-huh,"
the pilot said.
"You get called on crashes?"
"I have been, yes." For a decade, Norman Johnson had been on the list of FAA crash site teams, experts called on short notice to investigate civilian air disasters. The first time had been at the United Airlines crash in San Diego in 1976. Then he had been called to Chicago in 78 and Dallas in 82. Each time the pattern was the same. The hurried telephone call, frantic packing, the absence for a week or more. This time his wife Ellen had been annoyed because he was called away on July 1st, which meant he would miss their July 4th beach barbecue. Then, too, Tim was coming back from his sophomore year at Chicago on his way to a summer job in the Cascades, and Amy, now 16, was just back from Andover, and Amy and Ellen didn't get along very well if Norman wasn't there to mediate. The Volvo was making noises again. And it was possible Norman might miss his mother's birthday the following week.
"What crash is it?"
Ellen had said. "I haven't heard about any crash." She turned on the radio while he packed. There was no news on the radio of an airline crash. When the car pulled up in front of his house, Norman had been surprised to see it was a Navy pool sedan with a uniformed Navy driver.
"They never sent a Navy car the other times," Ellen said, following him down the stairs to the front door.
"Is this a military crash?"
"I don't know," he said. "When will you be back?"
He kissed her. "I'll call you," he said. "Promise." But he hadn't called. Everyone had been polite and pleasant, but they had kept him away from telephones. First at Hickam Field in Honolulu, then at the Naval Air Station in Guam, where he had arrived at 2 a.m. and had spent half an hour in a room that smelled of aviation gasoline, staring dumbly at an issue of the American Journal of Psychology, which he had brought with him, before flying on. He arrived at Pongo Pongo just as dawn was breaking.
Norman was hurried onto the big Sea Knight helicopter, which immediately lifted off the cold tarmac and headed west, over palm trees and rusty corrugated rooftops, into the Pacific. He had been on this helicopter for 2 hours, sleeping part of the time. Ellen and Tim and Amy and his mother's birthday now seemed very far away. Where exactly are we?
Between Samoa and Fiji in the South Pacific, the pilot said.
Can you show me on the chart?
I'm not supposed to do that, sir. Anyway, it wouldn't show much. Right now, you're 200 miles from anywhere, sir.
Norman stared at the flat horizon, still blue and featureless. I can believe it, he thought. He yawned. Don't you get bored looking at that?
To tell you the truth, no, sir, the pilot said. I'm real happy to see it flat like this. At least we've got good weather. And it won't hold. There's a cyclone forming up in the Admiralties. Should swing down this way in a few days.
What happens then?
Everybody clears the hell out. Weather can be tough in this part of the world, sir. I'm from Florida, and I saw some hurricanes when I was a kid, but you've never seen anything like a Pacific cyclone, sir.
Norman nodded.
How much longer until we get there? Any minute now, sir.
After 2 hours of monotony, the cluster of ships appeared unusually interesting. There were more than a dozen vessels of various kinds, formed roughly into concentric circles. On the outer perimeter, he counted 8 gray Navy destroyers. Closer to the center were large ships that had wide-spaced double hulls and looked like floating dry docks. Then, nondescript, boxy ships with flat helicopter decks. And in the center, amid all the gray, 2 white ships, each with a flat pad and a bullseye. The pilot listed them off.
You got your destroyers on the outside for protection. RVS is further in, that's remote vehicle support for the robots. Then MSS, mission support and supply. And OSRVs in the center.
OSRVs?
Oceanographic Survey and Research Vessels.
The pilot pointed to the white ships.
John Hawes to port and William Arthur to starboard. We'll put down on the Hawes.
The pilot circled the formation of ships. Norman could see launches running back and forth between the ships, leaving small white wakes against the deep blue of the water.
All this for an airplane crash?
Norman said.
Hey,
the pilot grinned.
I never mentioned a crash. Check your seatbelt if you would, sir. We're about to land.
Barnes. The red bullseye grew larger and slid beneath them as the helicopter touched down. Norman fumbled with his seatbelt buckle as a uniformed Navy man ran up and opened the door.
Dr. Johnson? Norman Johnson?
That's right.
Have any baggage, sir?
Just this. Norman reached back, pulled out his day case. The officer took it.
Any scientific instruments? Anything like that?
No, that's it.
This way, sir. Keep your head down, follow me, and don't go aft, sir.
Norman stepped out, ducking beneath the blades. He followed the officer off the helipad and down a narrow stairs. The metal handrail was hot to the touch. Behind him, the helicopter lifted off, the pilot giving him a final wave. Once the helicopter had gone, the Pacific air felt still and brutally hot.
Good trip, sir?
Fine.
Need to go, sir?
I've just arrived, Norman said.
No, I mean, you need to use the head, sir.
No, Norman said.
Good, don't use the heads, they're all backed up.
All right. Plumbing's been screwed up since last night. We're working on the problem and hope to have it solved soon. He peered at Norman.
We have a lot of women on board at the moment, sir.
I see, Norman said.
There's a chemical, John, if you need it, sir.
I'm okay, thanks.
In that case, Captain Barnes wants to see you at once, sir.
I'd like to call my family.
You can mention that to Captain Barnes, sir.
They ducked through a door, moving out of the hot sun into a fluorescent-lit hallway. It was much cooler.
Air conditioning hasn't gone out lately, the officer said. At least that's something.
Does the air conditioning go out often?
Only when it's hot.
Through another door, and into a large workroom. Metal walls, racks of tools, acetylene torches spraying sparks as workmen hunched over metal pontoons and pieces of intricate machinery, cables snaking over the floor.
We do ROV repairs here, the officer said, shouting over the din. Most of the heavy work is done on the tenders. We just do some of the electronics here. We go this way, sir.
through another door, down another corridor, and into a wide, low-ceilinged room crammed with video monitors. A half-dozen technicians sat in shadowy half-darkness before the color screens. Norman paused to look. "This is where we monitor the ROVs," the officer said. "We've got 3 or 4 robots down on the bottom at any given time, plus the MSBs and the FDs, of course." Norman heard the crackle and hiss of radio communications, soft fragments of words he couldn't make out. On one screen he saw a diver walking on the bottom. The diver was standing in harsh artificial light, wearing a kind of suit Norman had never seen, heavy blue cloth, and a bright yellow helmet sculpted in an odd shape. Norman pointed to the screen. "How deep is he?"
"I don't know, 1,000, 1,200 feet, something like that."
"And what have they found?"
"So far, just the big titanium fin."
The officer glanced around.
"It doesn't read on any monitors now. Bill, can you show Dr. Johnson here the fin?"
"Sorry, sir," the technician said. "Present main comm ops is working north of there in Quadrant 7.
"Ah, Quad 7's almost half a mile away from the fin,"
the officer said to Norman.
"Too bad. It's a hell of a thing to see.
But you'll see it later, I'm sure. This way to Captain Barnes." They walked for a moment down the corridor. Then the officer said, "Do you know the captain, sir?"
"No. Why?"
"Just wondered. He's been very eager to see you. Calling up the contacts every hour to find out when you're arriving."
"No," Norman said. "I've never met him."
"Very nice man."
"I'm sure."
The officer glanced over his shoulder.
"You know, they have a saying about the captain," he said.
"Oh, what's that?"
"They say his bite is worse than his bark."
Through another door, which was marked Project Commander, and had beneath that a sliding plate that said Captain Harold C. Barnes, USN. The officer stepped aside, and Norman entered a paneled stateroom. A burly man in shirt sleeves stood up from behind a stack of files. Captain Barnes was one of those trim military men who made Norman feel fat and inadequate. In his middle 40s, Hal Barnes had erect military bearing, an alert expression, short hair, a flat gut, and a politician's firm handshake. "Welcome aboard the Hawes, Dr. Johnson. How are you feeling?"
"Tired," Norman said.
"I'm sure, I'm sure. You came from San Diego?"
"Yes."
"So it's 15 hours, give or take. Like to have a rest?"
"I'd like to know what's going on," Norman said.
"Perfectly understandable," Barnes nodded. "What did they tell you?"
"Who?"
"The men who picked you up in San Diego, the men who flew you out here, the men in Guam, whatever."
"They didn't tell me anything."
"And did you see any reporters, any press?"
"No, nothing like that."
Barnes smiled. "Good, I'm glad to hear it." He waved Norman to a seat. Norman sat gratefully. "How about some coffee?" Barnes said, moving to a coffee maker behind his desk. And then the lights went out. The room was dark, except for the light that streamed in from a side porthole.
"God damn it," Barnes said.
"Not again.
Emerson! Emerson!"
An ensign came in a side door.
"Sir, working on it, Captain."
"What was it this time?"
"Blew out in ROV Bay 2, sir."
"I thought we added extra lines to Bay 2.
"Apparently they overloaded anyway, sir."
"I want this fixed now, Emerson."
"We hope to have it solved soon, sir."
The door closed. Barnes sat back in his chair. Norman heard the voice in the darkness. "It's not really their fault," he said. "These ships weren't built for the kind of power loads we put on them now, and..."
"Ah, there we are."
The lights came back on. Barnes smiled.
"Did you say you wanted coffee, Dr. Johnson?"
"Black is fine," Norman said.
Barnes poured him a mug.
"Anyway, I'm relieved you didn't talk to anybody.
In my job, Dr. Johnson, security is the biggest worry. Especially on a thing like this. If word gets out about this site, we'll have all kinds of problems. And so many people are involved now. Hell, CINCOM PAC didn't even want to give me destroyers until I started talking about Soviet submarine reconnaissance. The next thing, I get 4, then 8 destroyers."
"Soviet submarine reconnaissance?"
Norman asked. "That's what I told him in Honolulu." Barnes grinned. "Part of the game, to get what you need for an operation like this. You've got to know how to requisition equipment in the modern Navy. But, of course, the Soviets won't come around."
"They won't?"
Norman felt he had somehow missed the assumptions that lay behind the conversation and was trying to catch up.
"It's very unlikely. Oh, they know we're here.
They'll have spotted us with their satellites at least 2 days ago, but we're putting out a steady stream of decodable messages about our search and rescue exercises in the South Pacific. SNR drill represents a low priority for them, even though they undoubtedly figure a plane went down and we're recovering for real. They may even suspect that we're trying to recover nuclear warheads like we did off of Spain in 68, but they'll leave us alone, because politically they don't want to be implicated in our nuclear problems. They know we have troubles with New Zealand these days.
Is that what all this is? Norman said. Nuclear warheads?
No, Barnes said. Thank God. Anything nuclear, somebody in the White House always feels duty-bound to announce it. But we've kept this one away from the White House staff. In fact, we bypassed the JCS on this. All briefings go straight from the Defense Secretary to the President personally. He rapped his knuckles on the desk. So far, so good. And you're the last to arrive. Now that you're here, we'll shut this thing down tight. Nothing in, nothing out.
Norman still couldn't put it together. If nuclear warheads aren't involved in the crash, he said, why the secrecy?
Well, Barnes said, we don't have all the facts yet.
The crash occurred in the ocean?
Yes, more or less directly beneath us as we sit here.
And there can't be any survivors.
Survivors?
Barnes looked surprised.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Then why was I called here?
Barnes looked blank.
Well, Norman explained, I'm usually called to crash sites when there are survivors. That's why they put a psychologist on the team to deal with the acute traumatic problems of surviving passengers, or sometimes the relatives of surviving passengers, their feelings and their fears and their recurring nightmares. People who survive a crash often experience all sorts of guilt and anxiety concerning why they survived and not others. A woman sitting with her husband and children, suddenly they're all dead and she alone is alive, that kind of thing.
Norman sat back in his chair. But in this case, an airplane that crashed in 1,000 feet of water, there wouldn't be any of those problems, so why am I here?
Barnes was staring at him. He seemed uncomfortable. He shuffled the files around on his desk.
Actually, this isn't an airplane crash site, Dr. Johnson.
What is it?
It's a spacecraft crash site.
There was a short pause. Norman nodded.
I see. That doesn't surprise you, Barnes said.
No, Norman said. As a matter of fact, it explains a lot. If a military spacecraft crashed in the ocean, that explains why I haven't heard anything about it on the radio, why it was kept secret, why I was brought here the way I was.
When did it crash?
Barnes hesitated just a fraction before answering.
As best we can estimate, he said, this spacecraft crashed 300 years ago. ULF.
There was a silence. Norman listened to the drone of the air conditioner. He heard faintly the radio communications in the next room. He looked at the mug of coffee in his hand, noticing a chip on the rim. He struggled to assimilate what he was being told, but his mind moved sluggishly, in circles. 300 years ago, he thought. A spacecraft 300 years old. But the space program wasn't 300 years old, it was barely 30 years old. So how could a spacecraft be 300 years old? It couldn't be. Barnes must be mistaken. But how could Barnes be mistaken? The Navy wouldn't send all these ships, all these people, unless they were sure what was down there. A spacecraft, 300 years old. But how could that be? It couldn't be. It must be something else. He went over it again and again, getting nowhere, his mind dazed and shocked.
Absolutely no question about it, Barnes was saying. We can estimate the date from coral growth with great accuracy. Pacific coral grows 2 centimeters a year, and the object, whatever it is covered in about 10 meters of coral. That's a lot of coral. Of course, coral doesn't grow at a depth of 1,000 feet, which means that the present shelf collapsed to a lower depth at some point in the past. The geologists are telling us that happened about a century ago. So we're assuming a total age for the craft of about 300 years. But we could be wrong about that. It could, in fact, be much older. It could be 1,000 years old.
Barnes shifted papers on his desk again, arranging them into neat stacks, lining up the edges. I don't mind telling you, Dr. Johnson, this thing scares the hell out of me. That's why you're here. Norman shook his head. I still don't understand. We brought you here, Barnes said, because of your association with the ULF project.
ULF?
Norman said. And he almost added, but ULF was a joke. Seeing how serious Barnes was, he was glad he had caught himself in time. Yet ULF was a joke. Everything about it had been a joke from the very beginning. In 1979, in the waning days of the Carter administration, Norman Johnson had been an assistant professor of psychology at the University of California at San Diego. His particular research interest was group dynamics and anxiety, and he occasionally served on FAA crash site teams. In those days, his biggest problems had been finding a house for Ellen and the kids, keeping up his publications, and wondering whether UCSD would give him tenure. Norman's research was considered brilliant, but psychology was notoriously prone to intellectual fashions, and interest in the study of anxiety was declining, as many researchers came to regard anxiety as a purely biochemical disorder that could be treated with drug therapy alone. One scientist had even gone so far as to say, anxiety is no longer a problem in psychology, there is nothing left to study. Similarly, group dynamics was perceived as old-fashioned, a field that had seen its heyday in the Gestalt and countergroups and corporate brainstorming procedures of the early 1970s, but now was dated and passé. Norman himself could not comprehend this. It seemed to him that American society was increasingly one in which people worked in groups, not alone. Rugged individualism was now replaced by endless corporate meetings and group decisions. In this new society, group behavior seemed to him more important, not less, and he did not think that anxiety, as a clinical problem, was going to be solved with pills. It seemed to him that a society in which the most common prescription drug was Valium was, by definition, a society with unsolved problems. Not until the preoccupation with Japanese managerial techniques in the 1980s did Norman's field gain a new hold on academic attention. Around the same time, Valium dependence became recognized as a major concern, and the whole issue of drug therapy for anxiety was reconsidered. But in the meantime, Johnson spent several years feeling as if he were in a backwater. He did not have a research grant approved for nearly 3 years. Tenure and finding a house were very real problems. It was during the worst of this time, in late 1979, that he was approached by a solemn young lawyer from the National Security Council in Washington, who sat with his ankle across his knee and plucked nervously at his sock. The lawyer told Norman that he had come to ask his help. Norman said he would help if he could. Still plucking at the sock, the lawyer said he wanted to talk to Norman about a grave matter of national security facing our country today. Norman asked what the problem was. "Simply that this country has absolutely no preparedness in the event of an alien invasion. Absolutely no preparedness whatever." Because the lawyer was young, and because he stared down at his sock as he spoke, Norman at first thought he was embarrassed at having been sent on a fool's errand. But when the young man looked up, Norman saw, to his astonishment, that he was utterly serious. "We could really be caught with our pants down on this one," the lawyer said. "An alien invasion." Norman had to bite his lip. "That's probably true," he said. "People in the administration are worried." "Are they?" "There is the feeling at the highest levels that contingency plans should be drawn." "You mean contingency plans in the event of an alien invasion?" Norman somehow managed to keep a straight face. "Perhaps," said the lawyer, "perhaps invasion is too strong a word. Let's soften that to say contact, alien contact." "I see. You're already involved in civilian crash site teams, Dr. Johnson. You know how these emergency groups function. We want your input concerning the optimal composition of a crash site team to confront an alien invader."
"I see," Norman said, wondering how he could tactfully get out of this. The idea was clearly ludicrous. He could see it only as displacement. The administration, faced with immense problems it could not solve, had decided to think about something else.
And then the lawyer coughed, proposed a study, and named a substantial figure for a 2-year research grant. Norman saw a chance to buy his house. He said yes.
I'm glad you've agreed the problem is a real one.
Oh, yes, Norman said, wondering how old this lawyer was. He guessed about 25.
We'll just have to get your security clearance, the lawyer said.
I need security clearance?
Dr. Johnson, the lawyer said, snapping his briefcase shut, this project is top, top secret.
That's fine with me, Norman said, and he meant it. He could imagine his colleagues' reactions if they ever found out about this. What began as a joke soon became simply bizarre. Over the next year, Norman flew 5 times to Washington for meetings with high-level officials of the National Security Council over the pressing, imminent danger of alien invasion. His work was very secret. One early question, whether his project should be turned over to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency of the Pentagon. They decided not to. There were questions about whether it should be given to NASA, and again, they decided not to. One administration official said, this isn't a scientific matter, Dr. Johnson. This is a national security matter. We don't want to open it out. Norman was continually surprised at the level of the officials he was told to meet with. One senior undersecretary of state pushed aside the papers on his desk relating to the latest Middle East crisis to say, what do you think about the possibility that these aliens will be able to read our minds?
I don't know, Norman said.
Well, it occurs to me, how are we going to be able to formulate a negotiating posture if they can read our minds?
That could be a problem, Norman agreed, sneaking a glance at his watch.
Hell, it's bad enough our encrypted cables get intercepted by the Russians. We know the Japanese and the Israelis have cracked all our codes. We just pray the Russians can't do it yet. But you see what I mean, the problem, about reading minds.
Oh, yes.
Your report will have to take that into consideration.
Norman promised it would. A White House staffer said to him, you realize the president will want to talk to these aliens personally. He's that kind of man.
Uh-huh, Norman said. And I mean the publicity value here. The exposure is incalculable. The president meets with the aliens at Camp David. What a media moment.
A real moment, Norman agreed.
So the aliens will need to be informed by an advance man of who the president is and the protocol in talking to him. You can't have the president of the United States talking to people from another galaxy or whatever on television without advance preparation. Do you think the aliens will speak English?
Doubtful, Norman said.
So someone may need to learn their language, is that it?
It's hard to say. Perhaps the aliens would be more comfortable meeting with an advance man from one of our ethnic minorities, the White House man said.
Anyway, it's a possibility. Think about it.
Norman promised he would think about it.
The Pentagon liaison, a major general, took him to lunch and, over coffee, casually asked, what sorts of armaments do you see these aliens having?
I'm not sure, Norman said.
Well, that's the crux of it, isn't it?
And what about their vulnerabilities? I mean, the aliens might not even be human at all.
No, they might not. They might be like giant insects. Your insects can withstand a lot of radiation.
Yes, Norman said.
We might not be able to touch these aliens, the Pentagon man said gloomily. Then he brightened. But I doubt they could withstand a direct hit with a multi-meg nuclear device, do you?
No, Norman said. I don't think they could.
It'd vaporize them.
Sure.
Laws of physics.
Right.
Your report must make that point clearly. How about the nuclear vulnerability of these aliens?
Yes, Norman said.
We don't want to start a panic, the Pentagon man said. No sense getting everyone upset, is there? I know the JCS will be reassured to hear the aliens are vulnerable to our nuclear weapons.
I'll keep that in mind, Norman said.
Eventually, the meetings ended, and he was left to write his report. And as he reviewed the published speculations on extraterrestrial life, he decided that the major general from the Pentagon was not so wrong after all. The real question about alien contact, if there was any real question at all, concerned panic, psychological panic. The only important human experience with extraterrestrials had been Orson Welles' 1938 radio broadcast of The War of the Worlds, and the human response was unequivocal. People had been terrified. Norman submitted his report, entitled, Contact with Possible Extraterrestrial Life.
It was returned to him by the NSC with the suggestion that the title be revised to sound more technical, and that he remove any suggestion that alien contact was only a possibility, as alien contact is considered virtually certain in some quarters of the administration. Revised, Norman's paper was duly classified top secret, under the title, Recommendations for the Human Contact Team to Interact with Unknown Life Forms, ULF. As Norman envisioned it, the ULF contact team demanded particularly stable individuals. In his report, he had said, I wonder, Barnes said, opening a folder, if you recognize this quote. Contact teams meeting an unknown life form, ULF, must be prepared for severe psychological impact. Extreme anxiety responses will almost certainly occur. The personality traits of individuals who can withstand extreme anxiety must be determined, and such individuals selected to comprise the team. Anxiety, when confronted by unknown life, has not been sufficiently appreciated. The fears unleashed by contact with a new life form are not understood and cannot be entirely predicted in advance. But the most likely consequence of contact is absolute terror. Barnes snapped the folder shut. You remember who said that? Yes, Norman said, I do. And he remembered why he had said it. As part of the NSC grant, Norman had conducted studies of group dynamics in contexts of psychosocial anxiety. Following the procedures of Ash and Milgram, he constructed several environments in which subjects did not know they were being tested. In one case, a group of subjects were told to take an elevator to another floor to participate in a test. The elevator jammed between floors. Subjects were then observed by hidden video camera. There were several variations to this. Sometimes the elevator was marked under repair. Sometimes there was telephone communication with the repairman, sometimes not. Sometimes the ceiling fell in and the lights went out. And sometimes the floor of the elevator was constructed of clear lucite. In another case, subjects were loaded into a van and driven out into the desert by an experiment leader who ran out of gas and then suffered a heart attack, thus stranding the subjects. In the most severe version, subjects were taken up in a private plane, and the pilot suffered a heart attack in midair. Despite the traditional complaints about such tests, that they were sadistic, that they were artificial, that subjects somehow sensed the situations were contrived, Johnson gained considerable information about groups under anxiety stress. He found that fear responses were minimized when the group was small, five or less, when group members knew each other well, when group members could see each other and were not isolated, when they shared defined group goals and fixed time limits, when groups were mixed age and mixed gender, and when group members had high phobic tolerant personalities, as measured by LAS tests for anxiety, which in turn correlated with athletic fitness. Study results were formulated in dense statistical tables, although in essence Norma knew he had merely verified common sense. If you were trapped in an elevator, it was better to be with a few relaxed athletic people you knew, to keep the lights on, and to know someone was working to get you free. Yet Norman knew that some of his results were counterintuitive, such as the importance of group composition. Groups composed entirely of men or entirely of women were much poorer at handling stress than mixed groups. Groups composed of individuals roughly the same age were much poorer than groups of mixed age. And pre-existing groups formed for another purpose did worst of all. At one point he had stressed a championship basketball team, and it cracked almost immediately. Although his research was good, Norman remained uneasy about the underlying purpose for his paper, Alien Invasion, which he personally considered speculative to the point of absurdity. He was embarrassed to submit his paper, particularly after he had rewritten it to make it seem more significant than he knew it was. He was relieved when the Carter administration did not like his report. None of Norman's recommendations was approved. The administration did not agree with Dr. Norman Johnson that fear was a problem. They thought the predominant human emotion would be wonder and awe. Furthermore, the administration preferred a large contact team of 30 people, including 3 theologians, a lawyer, a physician, a representative from the State Department, a representative from the Joint Chiefs, a select group from the legislative branch, an aerospace engineer, an exobiologist, a nuclear physicist, a cultural anthropologist, and a television anchor personality. In any case, President Carter was not re-elected in 1980, and Norman heard nothing further about his ULF proposal. He had heard nothing for 6 years. Until now. Barnes said, "You remember the ULF team you proposed?" "Of course," Norman said. Norman had recommended a ULF team of four, an astrophysicist, a zoologist, a mathematician, a linguist, and a fifth member, a psychologist, whose job would be to monitor the behavior and attitude of the working team members. "Give me your opinion of this," Barnes said. He handed Norman a sheet of paper. "Anomaly Investigation Team. USN staff, support members. 1. Harold C. Barnes, USN Project Commander Captain. 2. Jane Edmonds, USN Data Processing Tech PO First Class. 3. Tina Chan, USN Electronics Tech PO First Class. 4. Alice Fletcher, USN DeepSat Habitat Support Chief PO. 5. Rose C. Levy, USN DeepSat Habitat Support Second Class. Civilian staff members. 1. Theodore Fielding, astrophysicist, planetary geologist. 2. Elizabeth Halpern, zoologist, biochemist. 3. Harold J. Adams, mathematician, logician. 4. Arthur Levine, marine biologist, biochemist. 5. Norman Johnson, psychologist. Norman looked at the list. "Except for Levine, this is the civilian ULF team I originally proposed. I even interviewed them and tested them back then." "Correct. But you said yourself there are probably no survivors. There's probably no life inside that spacecraft." "Yes," Barnes said. "But what if I'm wrong?" He glanced at his watch. "I'm going to brief the team members at 1100 hours. I want you to come along and see what you think about the team members," Barnes said. "After all, we followed your ULF report recommendations." "You followed my recommendations," Norman thought with a sinking feeling. "Jesus Christ, I was just paying for a house." "I knew you'd jump at the opportunity to see your ideas put into practice," Barnes said. "That's why I've included you on the team as the psychologist, although a younger man would be more appropriate." "I appreciate that," Norman said. "I knew you would," Barnes said, smiling cheerfully. He extended a beefy hand. "Welcome to the ULF team, Dr. Johnson." Beth. An ensign showed Norman to his room, tiny and gray, more like a prison cell than anything else. Norman's day bag lay on his bunk. In the corner was a computer console and a keyboard. Next to it was a thick manual with a blue cover. He sat on the bed, which was hard, unwelcoming. He leaned back against a pipe on the wall. "Hi, Norman," a soft voice said. "I'm glad to see they dragged you into this. This is all your fault, isn't it?" A woman stood in the doorway. Beth Halpern, the team zoologist, was a study in contrasts. She was a tall, angular woman of 36 who could be called pretty despite her sharp features and the almost masculine quality of her body. In the years since Norman had last seen her, she seemed to have emphasized her masculine side even more. Beth was a serious weightlifter and runner. The veins and muscles bulged at her neck and on her forearms, and her legs beneath her shorts were powerful. Her hair was cut short, hardly longer than a man's. At the same time, she wore jewelry and makeup, and she moved in a seductive way. Her voice was soft, and her eyes were large and liquid, especially when she talked about the living things that she studied. At those times, she became almost maternal. One of her colleagues at the University of Chicago had referred to her as Mother Nature with muscles. Norman got up, and she gave him a quick peck on the cheek. "My room's next to yours. I heard you arrive. When did you get in?" "An hour ago. I think I'm still in shock," Norman said. "Do you believe all this? Do you think it's real?" "I think that's real." She pointed to the blue manual next to his computer. Norman picked it up. "Regulations governing personnel conduct during classified military operations." He thumbed through pages of dense legal text. "It basically says," Beth said, "that you keep your mouth shut or you spend a long time in military prison, and there's no calls in or out." "Yes, Norman, I think it must be real." There's a spacecraft down there? There's something down there. It's pretty exciting. She began to speak more rapidly. Why, for biology alone, the possibilities are staggering. Everything we know about life comes from studying life on our own planet. But in a sense, all life on our planet is the same. Every living creature, from algae to human beings, is basically built on the same plan, from the same DNA. Now we may have a chance to contact life that is entirely different. Different in every way. It's exciting, all right. Norman nodded. He was thinking of something else. What did you say about no calls in or out? I promised to call Ellen. Well, I tried to call my daughter, and they told me the mainland comlinks are out, if you can believe that. The Navy's got more satellites than admirals, but they swear there's no available line to call out. Barnes said he'd approve a cable, that's it. How old is Jennifer now? Norman asked, pleased to pull the name from his memory. And what was her husband's name? He was a physicist, Norman remembered, something like that. Sandy, blonde man, had a beard, wore bow ties. 9. She's pitching for the Evanston Little League now. Not much of a student, but a hell of a pitcher. She sounded proud. How's your family? Ellen? She's fine. The kids are fine. Tim's a sophomore at Chicago. Amy's at Andover. How is... George? We divorced 3 years ago, Beth said. George had a year at CERN in Geneva looking for exotic particles, and I guess he found whatever he was looking for. She's French. He says she's a great cook. She shrugged. Anyway, my work is going well. For the past year, I've been working with cephalopods, squid and octopi. How's that? Interesting. It gives you quite a strange feeling to realize the gentle intelligence of these creatures, particularly octopi. You know, an octopus is smarter than a dog and would probably make a much better pet. It's a wonderful, clever, very emotional creature, an octopus. Only we never think of them that way. Norman said, do you still eat them? Oh, Norman, she smiled. Do you still relate everything to food? Whenever possible, Norman said, patting his stomach. Well, you won't like the food in this place. It's terrible. But the answer is no, she said, cracking her knuckles. I could never eat an octopus now, knowing what I do about them. Which reminds me, what do you know about Hal Barnes? Nothing. Why? I've been asking around. Turns out Barnes is not Navy at all. He's ex-Navy. You mean he's retired? Retired in 81. He was originally trained as an aeronautical engineer at Caltech, and after he retired, he worked for Grumman for a while, then a member of the Navy Science Board of the National Academy, then Assistant Undersecretary of Defense, and a member of DSARC, the Defense Systems Acquisition Review Council, a member of the Defense Science Board, which advises the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense. Advises them on what? Weapons acquisition, Beth said. He's a Pentagon man who advises the government on weapons acquisition. So how'd he get to be running this project? Beats me, Norman said. Sitting on the bunk, he kicked off his shoes. He felt suddenly tired. Beth leaned against the doorway. You seem to be in very good shape, Norman said. Even her hands looked strong, he thought. A good thing, too, as it turns out, Beth said. I have a lot of confidence for what's coming. What about you? Think you'll manage okay? Me? Why shouldn't I? He glanced down at his own familiar paunch. Ellen was always after him to do something about it. And from time to time he got inspired and went to the gym for a few days. But he could never seem to get rid of it. And the truth was, it didn't matter that much to him. He was 53 years old and he was a university professor. What the hell? Then he had a thought. What do you mean you have confidence for what's coming? What's coming? Well, it's only rumors so far. But your arrival seems to confirm them. What rumors? They're sending us down there. Beth said. Down where? To the bottom, to the spaceship. But it's 1,000 feet down. They're investigating it with robot submersibles. These days, 1,000 feet isn't that deep, Beth said. The technology can handle it. There are Navy divers down there now. And the word is the divers have put up a habitat so our team can go down and live on the bottom for a week or so and open the spacecraft up. Norman felt a sudden chill. In his work with the FAA, he had been exposed to every sort of horror. Once in Chicago, at a crash site that extended over a whole farm field, he had stepped on something squishy. He thought it was a frog, but it was a child's severed hand, palm up. Another time he had seen a man's charred body still strapped into the seat, except the seat had been flung into the backyard of a suburban house.